This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new movie, The Sweet Hereafter, is about the aftermath of a school bus crash that killed many of the children in a small town. As New York Times film critic Janet Maslin writes, the film offers a many-faceted moral inquiry. In the aftermath of such calamity, how does life go on? Maslin says, for all the suffering it describes, this eloquent film also carries the exhilaration of crystal-clear artistic vision. My guests are Adam Egoyan and Russell Banks. Egoyan directed the film and wrote the screenplay. Egoyan also wrote and directed Exotica. Russell Banks wrote the novel The Sweet Hereafter, which the movie is based on. One of Banks' earlier novels, Affliction, has been made into a not-yet-released film directed by Paul Schrader. Russell Banks, Adam Egoyan, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Russell Banks, I'd like to start with you. You said you came up with the idea of The Sweet Hereafter after reading about a school bus accident, I believe in a small Texas town.
That's right.
What did you see in that article that gave you the idea for the larger themes in your book? Like, what did you make of this article?
Well, it wasn't an article about an accident so much as about the aftermath of the accident, and I think that's what engaged my imagination from the start. I think it was the New York Times sent a reporter down to this small Mexican-American town in South Texas a year after the accident, and talked to the surviving families, and the town had more or less come apart for various reasons. But one of the reasons was that they had gotten all entangled in litigation and so on, and had lost their sense of community. And I think that attracted me more than any other aspect of it, because school bus accidents are, in a sense, I guess, endemic. I mean, they're all over the country. If you think about how many thousands and thousands of school buses are going out every morning, inevitably there's going to be an accident. So it wasn't the accident as such. It was the aftermath.
Adam Egoyan, why did you want to make The Sweet Hereafter into a movie? What did you see in it that fit your ideas as a filmmaker?
Well, I think first and foremost, I thought it was a great piece of drama. I think that this idea of what constitutes the truth and how far one goes in pursuing truth is told to us at so many different levels. There's that sense of what is the truth of a community, what keeps a community together, what are the shared values, what happens when something challenges that, provokes that, like this accident does. Who do you trust to put the truth back together? You, in the role of the litigation lawyer, Mitchell Stevens, coming into the town, going from household to household, saying that he has the truth or he can find out the truth. And then this remarkable story of a young woman who survives the accident, who has her own history and has her own truth that she has to find out, and who uses the structure of the litigation process to turn the whole case around, and by so doing, giving herself, empowering herself with her own truth. And it was just a complex moral story, and I couldn't get it out of my head.
No, the novel actually starts with the story of the school bus accident.
Mm-hmm.
And Russell Banks, I'd like you to read a paragraph from that description. And in this chapter, the school bus driver who was driving at the time of the accident but survives is looking back on that moment when she skidded on the road. And she's remembering that she saw something on the road. She saw some kind of blur that she really thought was a small animal, but she realizes now may have just been an optical illusion. But she decided to act as if it were a small animal just in case it was, and it was from turning the wheel and slamming on the brakes that she skidded off the road. Russell Banks, would you pick it up from there?
For the rest of my life, I will remember that red-brown blur like a stain of dried blood, standing against the road with a thin screen of blown snow suspended between it and me, the full weight of the vehicle and the 34 children in it bearing down on me like a wall of water. And I will remember the formal clarity of my mind, beyond thinking or choosing now, for I had made my choice as I wrenched the steering wheel to the right and slapped my foot against the brake pedal, and I wasn't the driver anymore. So I hunched my shoulders and ducked my head as if the bus were a huge wave about to break over me. There was Bear Otto and the Lambston kids and the Walkers, the Hamiltons and the Prescotts, and the teenage boys and girls from Bartlett Hill, and Risa and Wendell Walker's sad little boy, Sean, and sweet Nicole Burnell, and all the kids from the Valley, and the children from Wilmot Flats, and Billy Ansel's twins, Jessica and Mason, the children of my town, their wide-eyed faces and fragile bodies swirling and tumbling in a tangled mass as the bus went over and the sky tipped and veered away and the ground lurched brutally forward.
Now, Adam McGoyan, in the movie of The Sweet Hereafter, I want you to describe how you visually rendered that bus accident. There's no dialogue or voiceover in this scene. And it's actually a surprisingly quiet scene as the bus skids off the road. It's a pretty quiet skid, I guess, in part because of the snow. Snow tends to make things quiet. Describe how you decided to visually
handle this. Well, it's funny. This whole notion of depiction is so crucial to me. There are a couple of scenes in the film which depict catastrophe. And, of course, the bus accident is one of them. And for them to really have weight and bearing, it was important to ground them from the point of view of someone involved and what they would have experienced. And very often in an accident scene in a film, what we see is an attempt by the filmmaker to reconstruct the violence of that moment through a series of cuts and through the montage to give you a sense of what that incident is about, how violent that incident is. But what I was trying to create was what the experience of a parent watching this would have been. And of course, in the book, Billy Ansel, the parent of two of the children on the bus, follows them every morning and waves at the kids who are at the back. And he sees this happen. And to me, that was just almost unbearable, what this man would have witnessed and the helplessness of what he saw, or the helplessness of what he would have experienced as the bus went over. So I shot it from his point of view. And what you see is the bus rolling across, sliding across the frozen lake in the distance. And you see Billy in the foreground. And by showing it as something happening far away from him, you have a sense that he can't help and that he feels helpless. And in that sense, the moment when it occurs, you see the bus and it for a moment it seems to have rested to a stop on the lake, and you think everything is okay, then you hear the terrifying sound of the ice cracking and the bus falling through. And then you see Billy running towards them, but knowing that it's far too late for him to do anything. And that moment is then stored, because the tension of the scene is not broken by this barrage of angles and shots and explosive effects. The viewer has to hold it. And when it comes up later on that this is what Billy saw, you can understand and feel what he would have experienced.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Russell Banks and Adam McGoyan. Adam McGoyan has just made the film adaptation of Russell Banks' novel, The Sweet Hereafter. One of the kind of themes that holds together The Sweet Hereafter is the sense of, after a tragic accident like this bus accident, there's the impulse to find a guilty party, punish them, and get some compensation for this terrible thing that happened. And this is what the lawyer who comes to town tells everybody he can do. He can find a guilty party, he can sue them, everybody could get some money in damages. But then the other argument is, well, some things are just an accident. There is no guilty party. This just happened, and you have to live with it. There's nothing you can do. And I'm wondering, this is a very compelling theme, I'm wondering how that theme resonates in each of your lives, if it connects to something particular in your lives. Russell Banks, can we start with you?
Well, I suppose it does. I mean, the question of blame and causality is a central one in the book and as well as in the film. And it's certainly in my own personal life, I've been touched by that question, more than touched by it, occasionally driven by it, obsessed by it, maybe. Most specifically, and I should say, this is an underlying inspiration for the novel. My youngest brother was killed in an accident, in a train accident, when he was 17. And it was an inexplicable event. It was a mystery, finally. On two counts, I suppose it had a deep impact on me. It was 30 years ago now, but in one way, it fixed in my mind and lasted those 30 years is the way in which my mother responded to that. My mother's now in her 80s, and this event occurred over 30 years ago, but she still sees her life as bifurcated, as being in two parts, before and after the accident. She never has recovered, really. Her timeline has never recovered. So I saw that up close. I was a sibling, and so it didn't have the same impact on me. And the other way I think it had a huge and lasting impact on me is simply insofar as it forced me to live on with a mystery, a mystery having to do with causality. And I think this is something that we as Americans particularly are extremely reluctant to do, to live with a mystery, to live without an explanation.
Was there ever a lawsuit in the case of your brother?
Well, the opportunity for one was there, but no, there wasn't.
Which is interesting as well. I mean, we've talked about this, Russell. I mean, it's interesting how if the opportunity was there, maybe it was just a different time in American society, American culture, where there wasn't the same type of expectation that there would be an immediate lawsuit filed. I mean, I think that's one of the most fascinating aspects of the book, is that how in trying to convince one of the parents in particular to join him in this lawsuit, Mitchell Stevens, the lawyer, says, you know, it's not really for the money or to compensate you for the loss of your son, but it's to make sure that something like this will never happen again. So not only is it this idea of fate, and to what extent, you know, can something just happen, but also to make sure that something cannot just happen again.
Right.
that by putting it through a legal process, you can thereby limit the potential for accidents to occur.
Adam McGuire, can I ask how these things connect to your life in a direct way?
Ooh, I mean, it's difficult to respond after Russell's very direct personal response. I mean, I suppose there is an aspect of my background culturally which has to deal with this, and it's funny. It wasn't something I was aware of consciously when I did the adaptation of the book, but I think that as an Armenian, very much this idea of a catastrophe that befalls one's community, one's people. I mean, with the ideas of genocide of the Armenian people at the beginning of this century, and this notion of what to do with that history. I mean, it hasn't really ever been acknowledged. It's something that sort of lurks, and it's like, why did it have to happen? And what are the consequences? And how far do you go in pursuing truth? I mean, does one still try and look for answers, what, like now 80 years after the fact? Or what am I saying, 85 years after the fact? Do you try and get recognition from the people who perpetrated it? I mean, all these issues are still very alive in my life. And it's funny, because when we've shown the film, I mean, there have been journalists who have seen the community as being a metaphor for Armenian culture, but again, that wasn't something that was conscious as I was developing the project. But it may be one of the reasons why I find this such a moving story, because I personally am of the conviction that that the responses that ultimately affect one's life are the ones that you arrive at individually. That a communal response is always secondary to what the individual is able to draw out of an incident.
My guests are Russell Banks, who wrote the novel The Sweet Hereafter, and Adam McGuire, who wrote and directed the new film adaptation. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Russell Banks, who wrote the novel The Sweet Hereafter, and Adam McGuire, who wrote and directed the new film adaptation. There's a contrast in The Sweet Hereafter between the parents of the youngsters who were killed on the bus and the lawyer, who is also a parent. The children who were killed on the bus are, you know, they're young, they're helpless, they're totally innocent, in the sense that all they were doing was sitting on this bus that happened to crash over the guardrail. The lawyer, who is older than the parents of the children on the bus, he has a daughter who's in her late teens or early 20s, but she is also lost to him. She's alive, but she's a drug addict, and her only contact with him is to call him up and manipulate him to get more money for drugs. Before we talk about where this part of the story comes from, I'd like you, Russell Banks, to read a couple of lines from the section in the novel The Sweet Hereafter, in which the lawyer Stevenson talks about this.
The people of Sam Dent are not unique. We've all lost our children. It's like all the children of America are dead to us. Just look at them, for God's sake. Violent in the streets, comatose in the malls, narcotized in front of the TV. In my lifetime, something terrible happened that took our children away from us. I don't know if it was the Vietnam War or the sexual colonization of kids by industry or drugs or TV or divorce or what the hell it was. I don't know which are causes and which are effects, but the children are gone, that I know. So the trying to protect them is little more than an elaborate exercise in denial. Religious fanatics and super patriots, they try to protect their kids by turning them into schizophrenics. Episcopalians and high church Jews gratefully abandon their kids to boarding schools and divorce one another so they can get laid with impunity. The middle class grabs what it can buy and passes it on like poison candy on Halloween. And meanwhile, the inner city blacks and poor whites in the boonies sell their souls with longing for what's killing everyone else's kids and wonder why theirs are on crack. It's too late. They're gone. We're what's left.
Adam Magoyan, I'd like you to talk about what you did with this paragraph and this idea in incorporating it into the screenplay.
The real problem with this whole movie, this whole adaptation, was taking these first-person narratives and finding opportunities where these characters could actually say this to somebody.
Right.
In the book, they say it to the reader. They're talking to themselves. And the book is very much structured like a series of four depositions where the bus driver, the lawyer, the young survivor, and the father, Billy Ansel, speak their truths, tell their stories. So in the passage we've just heard, Russell is able to get right into Mitchell's psyche and to be able to have him express this tremendous sense of anger, rage, and disillusionment with his generation and the generation that he's raised. Now, how to find some character in this town that Mitchell could say that to was practically impossible. There is a character I invented in an airplane that Mitchell meets, who's the friend of, or used to be the friend of his best daughter, who's now a drug addict. And he does speak to her quite candidly, but not that particular section. That particular section is reserved for a meeting that he has with Billy Ansel, who's the one father, the one parent who will not be led to join Mitchell Stevens. And in a final desperate plea, Mitchell says to this man who's lost both his kids in this accident that he too has lost his daughter. But in a way, it's so audacious that Mitchell would try and use that as a lure, because what he's speaking about is something quite prosaic and quite, he can afford to. He has the luxury of being able to use language and to be able to use metaphor to use that to a man who has a very primal sense of loss and is trying to mourn something so directly is an affront, and it almost results in a violent physically violent moment between the two characters.
Well, let's hear your adaptation of the passage that we just heard Russell Banks read.
Yeah, and this is taking place outside the hulk of the bus. So we have the father coming to the bus and just really using it as a shrine, looking at this carcass which destroyed his two young kids. And then Mitchell Stevens, the lawyer, approaches him in the middle of the night and tells him this.
And we'll hear as the lawyer, Ian Holm, who gives a fantastic performance in The Sweet Hereafter.
Oh, I think it's a remarkable moment.
Several people in the town have agreed to let me represent them in a negligence suit. Now, your case as an individual will be stronger if I'm allowed to represent you together as a group.
Case?
The workers have agreed, the owners have agreed, Nicole Bunnell's parents. It's important that we initiate proceedings right away. Things get covered up. People lie. That's why we must begin our investigation quickly, before the evidence disappears. That's what I'm doing out here.
Listen, I know Risa and Wendell Walker. They wouldn't hire a goddamn lawyer. The Ottos, they wouldn't deal with you. We're not country bumpkins you can put the big city hustle on.
You're angry, Mr. Ansel. And you owe it to yourself to feel that way. All I'm saying is, let me direct your rage.
Thank you.
Maybe the police to tell me they found her dead. She's a drug addict.
Why are you telling me this?
Why am I telling you this, Mr. Ansel? Because we've all lost our children. They're dead to us. They're killing each other in the streets. They wander comatose shopping malls. Something terrible has happened. It's taken our children away.
Ian Holm and Bruce Greenwood in a scene from the new movie The Sweet Hereafter. Adam Egoyan wrote and directed the film. Russell Banks wrote the novel it's based on. Egoyan and Banks will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Russell Banks and Adam Egoyan. Egoyan wrote and directed the new movie The Sweet Hereafter. Banks wrote the novel it's based on. The story is about the aftermath of a school bus crash that killed many of the children in a small town. It's interesting, Adam Egoyan, you're 20 years younger than Russell Banks, and you have, I think, one young child?
Yes.
And Russell Banks, your child is an adult
I have
already.
Four, I actually have four daughters, four grown
daughters.
Oh,
okay. And they're all grown.
Thank God, yes.
So, Adam Egoyan, you're experiencing the story in a way more from the point of view of the parents who lost their young children on the school bus at that really kind of vulnerable age. I'm wondering if you feel like you both kind of approaching the story at different stages in your life affects how you read or viscerally respond to the story.
Well, it's again, I think what I was most drawn by was the character of Nicole. Now, even though in the film adaptation, Mitchell Stevens becomes the lead character, the defining action for me is not so much the bus crash, but rather what Nicole does in the deposition to turn the case around.
You should
around.
Describe who Nicole is.
Nicole is the young woman who survives the crash. She was one of the passengers on her way to school that morning. And she has a dark sort of chapter in her own background, her history, which is a secret to the community and which is causing her great anguish. And when the deposition comes about, she finds a way of being able to deal with that in a very, very courageous way, I think. So to me, and the reason why I made the film is that there's a tremendous sense of redemption and hope and grace through the actions of this survivor. And so as a parent, I mean, I could look at the action of a child who's able to do that and find great hope. I mean, as long as, one is able to take that sort of action, there is hope for our children, even in the light of a central character who says, we've lost our children. I suppose, and maybe that's something that I certainly need to believe as a new parent. I mean, I can't imagine being a parent and having such a dismal view of what rearing a child may result in.
Adam Egoyan, would you talk a bit about directing Ian Holm and what you thought about his line readings of lines that Russell Banks wrote, lines that you wrote, lines that you changed from Russell Banks' original. His spacing between words as he thinks is so perfect without being overdone and stagey.
Well, I think Ian Holm is certainly one of the finest actors working in the English language. He is a theater legend. He's very aware of using language to insinuate himself into someone else's experience while being able to talk of his own experience. So you have these passages in the film where he goes off on a story of a remembrance of a time in his own life. But the whole time he's telling this very, very compelling story, he's also aware of the effect that this story is having on the listener and how he's able to then open up the listener so that he may get something from them. So I needed to have an extraordinary actor who'd be able to understand what the power of language was, and also who'd be able to teach me, I think. And I think, you know, Russell and I are just, we're astonished by his ability to not only, I mean, in this case, to appropriate and to find a tempo in a dialect that's not his.
He actually educated me with regard to the novel. I mean, I learned about the novel and learned some things about myself as well, or as a result, I think. That story you mentioned that he tells on the plane about the time when his little girl, or when Zoe was a little girl and got stung by spiders, and they had to race across to a hospital, and he had to be prepared to perform an emergency tracheotomy and so forth. He tells that story in a way which is designed to... first of all, it's a horrible story. It was a terrible experience for him, but he's also using it to seduce the person sitting next to him, the young woman who's listening. And one doesn't know this, of course, no one but me, perhaps, and members of my family know, but that actually did happen to me and to my youngest daughter many years ago. It's probably the only totally autobiographical element in the novel. And it's a Banks family story, one I've told many times over the years. And on watching Ian deliver it, I realized that I've told it to seduce people, too. It was a terrible experience, but I used that story. I think the way probably all storytellers eventually use the stories from their past.
And you've used it what a good person you are, to show...
Probably, yeah, what a good dad I am, what a courageous guy I am.
Uh-huh.
Probably for the same reasons Ian Holm is telling the story to that young woman next to him. It's a good story, too. I mean, you know, it has drama, and it leads up to a point where which is finally, you know, terribly anticlimactic, where the young woman says, "And what happened?" And he says, "Oh, nothing." It's the storytelling that's important.
Russell Banks, how much did you work on the screenplay, or how much were you actually on the set during the making of the movie?
I didn't actually work on the screenplay. It's entirely Adams. I guess you could say I consulted, or I was consulted at every stage of the screenplay. To the point where one time Adam came down to my house and spent the weekend, and we went over the script line by line, a great event for me. And then I was present on the set for a few days. I had a little cameo, my one moment on the silver screen, although my best parts were left on the cutting room floor.
Oh, yeah, that's what they all say.
And sort of hovered around over Adam's shoulder during some of the editing and so forth. It was all informal and
yeah, and I think it was an incredibly generous on Russell's behalf. I mean, for me, since it was the first adaptation and since it was a book that I admired so profoundly, I don't think I would have been able to proceed if I didn't have Russell's blessing in some way. You know, I think in many cases during the adaptation process, the producers or the writers and the directors, they try and get the author out of the way as soon as possible. And I just couldn't imagine working that way. Now, I also had the luxury of being, in this case, the producer and the director as well. So I wasn't threatened, and Russell's contributions were just so extraordinarily important. I mean, I needed his blessing, I suppose, and he was always ready to give it, and also to help me. It was a first time for me. And I wanted to make sure that there are major changes, and I needed to have somebody respond to that who was I just felt from the very beginning, I suppose, that this relationship was really going to be very different from the classic Hollywood, you know, take the money and run type situation. It was really
It helped a lot, too, that from the very beginning, I was really interested and engaged by your films. So I was excited at the prospect of seeing you use this material and make a film from it. So as a fan of films generally and of your work particularly. So it was a very exciting kind of prospect for me when you brought me into it.
Mm-hmm. Adam Egoyan directed the new movie The Sweet Hereafter and wrote the screenplay. Russell Banks wrote the novel the film is based on. At this point in our conversation, our studio time with Adam Egoyan ran out, so we had to wrap up that end of the conversation. But Russell Banks was able to stay on the phone for a few more minutes, so our conversation will continue after a break. This is Fresh Air.